Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Everybody, this is Brett. This is School Sucks Across America, day 37. It is Monday morning, November 20th. I am in Nashville, Tennessee. It's hard to believe that at the end of this week, I will be back in New Hampshire. Also hard to believe that a week ago at this time, I was in Los Angeles, California. We logged a lot of miles this week, 2,500 almost, and the total mileage for School Sucks Across America over the last 36 days, 7,532. And it's just a magical experience every place I go for completely different reasons. You know, we were in Nashville, Tennessee last night, Memphis yesterday morning, and I wish I could sit here and tell you in detail about every stop in the last few days, but I'm in a hotel and they kick you out at 11, so I gotta hustle here. I've said we a couple of times. I think most of you know at this point that I've been doing the return trip with a friend of mine, an Australian who came from Australia to the Thaddeus Russell event. That's where he joined me in Los Angeles, and he's making the trip back up all the way to Boston with me. His name is Nick Ulbrich, and he is actually, I didn't want to announce this too early, but it looks like we're actually collecting enough footage to create, and this was Nick's goal, joining me on this trip, a documentary film partly about School Sucks Across America, but mostly about the school versus education problem and solution, as far as I'm concerned. So we've made a lot of progress on that, and I'm comfortable telling you that someday there will be a documentary film about this adventure. If you're a supporter, I hope you've been checking out our audio and video drive journals. We've done a couple long ones. Now, they're easier to do with somebody else. Nick has been in the car, and we've done like 2 hours in a couple sessions just in the past few days. So I hope you check those out. It'll give you more of a sense of what's going on out here. And then when I get home, man, you are going to have content from School Sucks Across America for at least the next month. So let's talk about today's show. We're going to return all the way back to day 14. It was October 28th. I was in St. Louis, Missouri. And the plan was to meet a couple of listeners for lunch in St. Louis. Kevin Cole, friend of mine, friend of the show, you know Kevin from Tragedy and Hope and unityofthepolis.com. He made the trip all the way up from the Missouri-Arkansas border. It was a few hours, and it was really, really important to him that I get a proper tour of the public school history of St. Louis. It was broader than public school, but it was really worth the extra time that I spent. I was always, this was kind of a turning point because I was still struggling with that not being present kind of thing that comes over you. It can come over you when you travel. Where's the next place I have to be? What time do I have to be there? And that can certainly subtract from the enjoyment of the place I am in when I'm worrying about such things. So I postponed my arrival in Kansas City to spend a couple hours with Kevin in St. Louis, and boy, was it worth it. And I learned from that experience, I think this was the final time I had to tell myself this, just be where you are. So Kevin acted as both a history teacher and a tour guide as I drove him around in my car. We were each holding a microphone, and we saw the sights, and we talked about the role of the St. Louis movement, something that I'm guessing most of you are unfamiliar with, in the shaping of not only American public schools, but to a certain degree, American society. Now, I highly recommend that you watch the video version of this. It's actually a series of videos because I was recording them in 4K, so the GoPro can only shoot for so long in 4K, so it's broken up into several parts. But there are, I think, four videos of us driving and then five very short videos of our final stop where we get out of the car at the City Museum. And if you've never heard of the City Museum in St. Louis, even though it's been voted the number one family attraction in the world, all I can say is it is a self-educating child's paradise. It was such an immersive experience. And we were in there for less than an hour. If you saw the pictures I posted, like, geez, more than 3 weeks ago, of first of all, me and Kevin Cole, but also the school bus over the edge of the building, that is from the City Museum. And if you check out some of these videos, you'll have a chance to see inside. But I really, really recommend, like, this podcast. I never say don't listen to this podcast, because why would I even put it out? It's just kind of an announcement that you could be watching video coverage of everything you're about to listen to. And it is a much richer experience, I would say, if you watch the videos. So huge thanks to Kevin Cole for encouraging me to hang around in St. Louis and doing an amazing job as teacher and tour guide. This was definitely a highlight of School Sucks Across America. So that's it. Thank you for listening, or hopefully watching this presentation. The videos are embedded right in the show notes at schoolsucksproject.com. If you're a patron, I recommend you just go there, because Patreon doesn't let me embed videos. And whew, it's 10:30, so I better get packing and posting and on to Knoxville. We're doing a meetup there tonight. There's a Facebook event if you're interested in attending. It's the closest I'm going to get to Asheville. I know a lot of people were interested in doing something in Asheville, but things are pretty fast and furious right now, making our way up the East Coast at this point. So maybe I'll see you in Knoxville or Richmond, Virginia, the night after that. Thanks again, everybody, for listening, for your support, for your encouragement. This has just been incredible, and I will talk to you again soon. Take care.
All right, so we should start while we're at this stoplight. Kevin Cole, welcome to School Sucks Podcast.
Great to be here.
On the road, in a car, driving around the city of St. Louis, I'm glad I ran into you because there's a lot of things about this city that I did not know. And over the next hour or so, we're gonna discover a few of them. You handed me a book called The American Hegelians when we sat down. Mm-hmm. Who's the author?
The author on that one is, William H. Goetzman.
And the first section of the book is called The St. Louis Movement, which was something that obviously impacted American public schooling quite heavily. We're going to try and do a bit of a guided tour, but also I want to listen to you tell this story about what actually happened here. So what would be a good place to start as far as the St. Louis movement is concerned?
Okay. Well, the St. Louis movement consists of William Torrey Harris, Denton Snyder, and a guy by the name of Henry Conrad Bruckmeyer, who was a Prussian soldier. And I'll go back a little bit in further history on this. There was a settlement in southern Illinois prior to it becoming a state. I believe it was in the early 1800s, 1813 or 1814. I believe it became a state in 1817, but I'd have to check the dates on that. But there was a settlement of British settlers.
Sorry to interrupt. There it is. Yep. Pestalozzi Street, as you promised.
Absolutely. That's named after Johann Pestalozzi. For those of you familiar with John Taylor Gatto's work, Johann Pestalozzi was an educator from Switzerland. He was all over Europe, and his methods were imported into the United States via several methods, one of which is discussed as the Oswego method, which was through Canada. But it also took place through this Hegelian deposit in St. Louis. Going back to southern Illinois, there is a settlement town before it became a state entitled Albion. And they named it Albion, obviously after the ancient name for Great Britain, for the island of Great Britain.
Right,
and this settlement of Albion, which was before Illinois was a state, helped to broker the sale of the New Harmony Utopian Society from the religious sect to Robert Owen. And Robert Owen, we know, is the industrialist from England who invented or coined the term socialism.
Right.
And so what took place was an individual by the name of George and Robert Flower, father and son, as well as Morris Birkbeck, settled in Albion, Illinois. And they were loyalists to Great Britain as a settlement, you know, outside of the 13 colonies before Illinois had become a state.
Yeah, you were saying that the British were just kind of like, okay, that is what it is. That's a new thing, but we will just...
Yeah.
And certainly this caused plenty of problems as the century wore on, but...
Oh, no, it did.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not only did it cause problems, when it did become a state, the local town of Mount Carmel rejected Albion as the county seat, and they marched all the way from Mount Carmel to Albion to demand that the county seat be resituated. And mm-hmm. when that wasn't done, they just cut counties, and it started a whole new county. So Albion still exists today, and in fact, one of the founders, Maurice Birkbeck, went on to become, I believe, the first Secretary of State in Illinois. And one of the founders of Albion wrote a very famous and well-known traveling report. This is how people found out about different regions of the world back in this period of time, is that somebody would have the money to go travel across Europe. They would write traveler's reports, and then this would spur a great deal of immigration into the United States. And so when this took place, he wrote, I believe it was Robert Flower, who wrote this this famous traveler's report, and this led to many of the Prussian soldiers who they called the, I believe, the 48ers. Mm-hmm. After the War of 1848 there, many Prussian soldiers came over to the United States to settle as a result of reading these traveler's reports. One of those was Henry Conrad Bruckmeyer. And when he got to St. Louis, he met up with a New Englander by the name of William Torrey Harris, who
yes.
I believe he was, William Torrey Harris is well known as one of the founders of modern schooling.
He was a U.S. Commissioner of Education, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct. He was a U.S. Commissioner of Education, I believe, from the late 1800s all the way into 1906. I actually wrote a paper on William Torrey Harris recently entitled William Torrey Harris, Mass Schooling and the Open Secret of the Universe, which details the creation of the Journal of Speculative Philosophy. Now, here in St. Louis, they viewed themselves as fulfilling the dialectic of Hegel. And the way that they were going to do this was that they were using speculative philosophy, much like speculative Freemasonry, which contains this German idealistic belief or acceptance of fact, depending on which side of the fence you're on, is that language is what dictates all learning. And mm-hmm. essentially, they understood that without the knowledge of a supreme name giver, which came down to give names to things, that all actions of human interaction were essentially art, and that we all come together under a communal understanding, under arbitrary definitions for social purpose. And this is how modern schooling got its start. And the first kindergarten was founded in St. Louis by Susan Blow, who was a protege of William Torrey Harris. Now, I should say it's the first public kindergarten, because there was a private kindergarten which took place in New England mm-hmm. under Horace Mann and some of his acolytes.
Right.
That went into the history of transcendentalism and Prussian education. William Torrey Harris essentially founded the first philosophical journal that existed in the United States. And they viewed St. Louis as being a front runner in the possible move of the United States Capitol to the Midwest, because they believed that Washington, D.C. wasn't going to last, and that the only real competition for second place where they could have the capital of the United States to be St. Louis and Chicago. And in fact, they celebrated when Chicago had a large portion of its city burned down, because
right.
they felt that this was going to allow them to establish preeminence. Now, William Torrey Harris, Henry Conrad Bruckmeyer, in this Journal of Speculative Philosophy, were the first to proliferate the works of Hegel as well as of Fichte in the United States. Adolf Kroger, one of the members of the Journal of Speculative Philosophy in the American Philosophical Society, was the most prolific translator of all of Fichte's work into the United States. And in fact, Fichte's son, Emanuel Fichte, was a honorary member of this society.
So what years are we talking here? Because it sounds like Hegel might even still be alive at this point.
This was 1886,
oh, okay.
I believe,
when
the society itself was founded. There was a kind of a confluence of New England transcendentalism under Bronson Alcott, if people are familiar with Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women. This was a confluence of the transcendentalist societies, as well as those that were trying to proliferate Hegel's idea of an organic state.
Now, for people who might be unfamiliar, transcendentalism, how that fits into that picture, what is the idea or the synopsis of transcendental?
Well, the synopsis of transcendentalism is essentially, there are several ways we could look at that. I think in the realization of what many of the German idealists came to, which was that essentially all language is arbitrary, and mm-hmm. that in order for there to be a unifying factor within society, we would have to come together in institutions. And this is very much a forerunner to things like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute of International Affairs, because this philosophy of liberal institutionalism is yeah, they weren't going to cross the street there. I don't know what was going on.
I don't
on.
Know. I see a college, and I assume they have the right of way.
Yeah, this is actually St. Louis University, which yeah. William Torrey Harris actually played a role in the founding of, I believe. I'd have to verify that. But essentially, transcendentalism was basically the idea that we no longer need to be bound to historical beliefs and historical and religious implications, and that we can transcend these ideals by recognizing a higher form of consciousness. And a lot of this is really tied into the history of the vegetarian movement and veganism. Robert Owen financed what was called Alcott House in England, mm-hmm. which was named after Bronson Alcott. And they started a newsletter called Seed Time. And so what this all really comes into to the big picture is to look at the work of John Taylor Gatto and in his expose of the methods of Johann Pestalozzi and why that's so important. Now, the New Harmony Utopian Society, which was founded by a religious sect, was then sold to Robert Owen. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to import Johann Pestalozzi's educational methods into this town of New Harmony in order to use it as an experiment to see if it would work on larger society, because mm-hmm. they wanted to divide people according to what occupation they would know best. And it was very much like a microcosm of the medieval universities in the historical trivium, which was a culture creation mechanism.
So then to kind of close those people into an almost homogeneous unit, where
Absolutely.
They would live together and
work yeah. on the same property,
right?
And he did this over in England as well. I can't remember the name of the town, but Robert Owen married into a industrialist family where his father-in-law had a factory, and Robert Owen reorganized this factory to where everybody would live on the site. They would all eat a strict vegetarian diet, and they would all go to work at uniform times. And that was the same purpose of doing this in the United States in New Harmony, Indiana, which today still exists as a historical city where you can go and tour and see where these educational ideas were tried to put into practice. Now, what's little known, and to break out the I word here for people, Johann Pestalozzi was a member of the Bavarian Illuminati started by Adam Weishaupt in 1776. Mm-hmm. Now, educational historian R.H. Quick has stated that Pestalozzi later in life got the better of these ideas, but who are we to say? I have found record of Alfred as the pseudonym for Johann Pestalozzi and the Illuminati, staying at Adam Weishaupt's house in Bavaria.
How were you able to make that connection that was his code name?
Well, they... All of the people in the Illuminati adopted these code names, many of them based on ancient Greece, like... Weishaupt was Spartacus. And so there are documents published by Terry Mollinson, as well as several other, Jiva Singh Anand and several other authors, Marco De Lucchetti, who have actually gone in and translated many of the Illuminati documents and figured out who the pseudonyms belong to. Like, for instance, the number two in the Illuminati under Weishaupt was a guy by the name of Adolf von Knigge, and he went by Philo.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a book by Jiva Singh Anand, who sadly is no longer with us, called Philo's Reply, which details his involvement in the Illuminati and what they actually were. Other members such as Johann Herder, who is responsible for many of the modern concepts of nationalism that we know today, was also a member of this society. But what Pestalozzi did was he went back to Switzerland, and he set up two schools. One was the Bergdorf School, where he took a bunch of orphans and he from all different backgrounds, and he tried to see if he could put them all in one place and homogenize them along one train of thought and one line of thinking.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
And so education up until this point had not been a very altruistic or, from their point of view, a very friendly affair. This had been under canon law, very strict Jesuit or Roman Catholic teachers, where it was corporal punishment. And Pestalozzi had this odd idea of, hey, why don't we not beat the kids? Like, why don't we not beat the kids and, mm-hmm. and see if we can educate them to all come together in one line of thinking? Now, the more famous school that he started was called the Virden School, or mm-hmm. Javierden School. And this school drew people from all over the world who became infatuated with his ideas on how to educate students. And he did this by essentially being nice to them and by trying to get them to come to terms with their own bodies. You know, if anybody's familiar with the concept of kindergarten, this comes from one of Pestalozzi's students, whose name is Friedrich Froebel,
yep.
who coined this kindergarten, where they believed that the student could just be placed into a garden and they would grow naturally, into their own self. And there are, you know, we can discuss problems of that idea at a later time. And as we have in the Ultimate History Lesson with John Taylor Gatto in the later commentary on that. But Robert Owen, as well as many others, would go to the Virden School and sit in on the classrooms. And what they would do is it was essentially like one of the first pedagogical seminaries in the world that was not under a strict religious rule. Now, they obviously had this for many years under the Roman Catholic Church, which controlled learning under the Ratio Studiorum and these earlier ideas of the liberal arts perpetuated on different classes of people in order to create occupations. Mm-hmm. And so one of the students of Johann Pestalozzi was an individual by the name of Joseph Neef. Now, Robert Owen, who himself boasts of his involvement with the Illuminati over time, the actual historical Illuminati, not the Jay-Z, Rihanna personification
right.
of this now in pop culture and movies and things like that, where this word is just kind of thrown out just as a dog whistle to anything secretive or anything that has an eye over a compass or in a pyramid. You know, it's a very cartoonification of what was taking place. Not
right.
to say that the Illuminati didn't have a lot of bad ideas, because they absolutely did. And a lot of despotic ideas, especially for people that come from a religious point of view. But this was a real group that existed and that sought to fight back against canonical law and the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, Adam Weishaupt was a professor of canon law, and he was the first one to do so, having not gone through the religious training to have it, which upset many of the Jesuits of his time, and they got him thrown out of the university. He had a lot of other despotic ideas that were then adopted by kings and potentates and people all across Europe in order to take over Freemasonry or to start like societies for secularist agendas and otherwise. They would use religious agendas if they could. But Johann Pestalozzi, Robert Owen thought, would be the perfect person to come to the United States and to teach at the New Harmony Utopian Society, mm-hmm. where they were setting up this industry of all the people that would live in the town and all work together in a cooperative arrangement where the food would be shared and it would all be based on strict dietary rules. But at that time, Johann Pestalozzi was too old. And he said, I'm sorry, you know, Mr. Owen, I'm not going to be able to do that. I'd like for you to take my protege. So he sent a Frenchman who had been a student of his by the name of Joseph Neef. And Joseph Neef becomes the first pedagogical educator in the United States. He first comes to Pennsylvania, where they start a society there. And then he moves on to New Harmony, Indiana. Several years ago, I went to New Harmony because I was very interested in this history. And I thought, you know, I'll go over there and see what the people at the museum know. And they weren't really too educated on who Joseph Neef was. I was able to go down the road and find his grave there on the property, and as well as the relatives of Johann Pestalozzi who came over after Pestalozzi was unable to teach within the communities. So the long story short is that these ideas of Robert Owen and the creation of a utopian society and a way to create an interdependence amongst people to try to root out a individualist effort within society and to try to force an organic union of minds was the original goal. And they wanted to do so for industry. And so in the addresses to the German nation, where after people know the Battle of Jena in 1806,
right.
The Prussians lost to Napoleon, and the king decided we need to create this address to figure out why this took place. And this they hired Johann Fichte, or Fichte. I pronounce it in several different ways. You'll have to forgive me. But they had him put together this report, and it ended up being the addresses to the German nations, 8 or 9 different addresses. But in this, Pestalozzi is named as the person that they would like to use to proliferate this national education system.
Right.
And so it was at the you know, national sovereignty goes back all the way to Westphalia in like 1648. This is where we get the ideas of a national sovereign that is not under a religious rule. But it took a long time for this to develop outside of that structure. You can find talks today by Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, I saw one the other day, which is entitled Global Order 2.0, because they viewed the previous order as the Global Order 1.0, and they kind of are having to adjust back to a new version of how states should interact on the international level. I feel like I'm getting a little bit off topic, but if people really study the bullet points that I'm discussing, you'll see that it all really ties into the idea of liberal institutionalism, that sovereignty does not exist within the individual or within the volitional group experience. It exists within a res publica, or what they call the public thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the topic of cybernetics has come up several times along the way.
Yes.
I've had a couple of conversations, and it sounds like, you know, you have this similar idea of being able to, you know, with the littlest force possible, have the most leverage for a large group of people. That's not a new idea. Obviously, well, I mean, cybernetics goes back to ancient Greece, but
sure. It
took so long with such an old idea to figure out that you could use school to accomplish this goal over a period of time.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's and the reason why that was is because schooling for such a long time had been controlled in the upper classes and in the elite. There was no real you didn't want the peasants or the people that were the mere workers for your factories or the human resources of their day to be able to think outside of that. You know, you could go into some of the quotes of Stephen Biko, which Richard Grove talks about a lot, and the ideas of even going back to Frederick Douglass and learning to read, and how much that how much leverage that gave him within society, where they really can't take that back. Once you educate the masses to understand the control structure, then you have people that are constantly stepping outside of that. Now, I think that cybernetics itself, going back to the root word cybernetes, it means the governor that steers the ship of state. So
Right. It
really is the same idea all throughout time. And it's all the way from, you know, from Plato and the noble lie through Marshall McLuhan and his ideas of all at onceness. You know, once the Gutenberg press came online, they couldn't put the genie back in the bottle, because you have a widespread proliferation of reading materials, and then people who are coming up with their own ideas that are contrary to those that would claim themselves to be the potentates or the kings of the time, those that were acting upon the virtue of the state, going back to what Isocrates called the virtue of kings. And it was the virtue of kings to be kind to their subjects in order to perpetuate a unity that they would inherently fall under.
Right. So just back to the car here for a minute.
Sure.
I've just been driving.
Yeah, I've been in my head, not paying attention. So,
and it's interesting. I wasn't being very mindful of my surroundings. We wound up in not the best looking area.
Actually, that's
okay. Reminded me of much of what I saw in Detroit. So,
I'm gonna map us back towards downtown.
Yeah, we're headed west now. So I'm just going to turn around and head in the other direction.
Yeah, just hop back on. Looks like
70.
Yeah,
and go east.
Yep. And that should take us back towards downtown. There's a rich history, and I'd love to do a whole podcast just going into the details of some of the books that I have on these topics. But I have a book by Henry Poachman, I believe, and that is New England Transcendentalism and the St. Louis Hegelianism, which kind of brings this into confluence. But for people that are starting in on some of these ideas of mass schooling and where it originates, I would just invite them to go to my website, unityofthepolis.com. And you can check out the paper I wrote, which is really an introduction into these ideas. And it's William Torrey Harris, Mass Schooling and the Open Secret of the Universe. And it really ties speculative philosophy, going back to Plato, in with the purposes of Freemasonry. Because the purposes of Freemasonry have always been to sow a unity amongst men, to be a builder of empire, but first in building men. Mm-hmm. And you do that by perpetuating a specific type of ethical guideline. And the way the Masons do that is through a kind of a ritual play that takes place over time. So you go through like the Entered Apprentice degree and the Fellow Craft degree and then the Master Mason degree. And these are all very like tertiary, you know, team building exercises. Think trust falls at your camp that you went to as a kid, you know. But you do this in a way that allows people to think that they're really getting a leg up on other people. Now, you can get a leg up on other people. You put a little star on the back of your car. You get pulled over by the Fraternal Order of Police. You might get let go because you're of a similar fraternal organization.
Right.
So these are all, you know, very intertwined ideas. The speculative Freemasonry beginning in 1717 and speculative philosophy concealed the same fact, which is what I said earlier, that all language is essentially art. And without knowledge of a supreme name giver, which gave names to things and defines the purpose of this reality, without those narratives of Christianity or Islam or whatever your foundation ideas are, you have a very hard time sowing a unity in whatever group you're creating. Mm-hmm. So for the United States, the early foundation myths we get in school are very, you know, altruistically based on the American Revolution and Judeo-Christian values and this constant throwing off of authority over time. Whether it be George Fox and the Quakers in the Mayflower colonies, where they were meeting in homes outside of the edicts of the Mayflower Compact, and they were rebelling against the official religion. This has been the foundation mythology as well as the truth of a lot of American history, is that it's the throwing off of authority, the throwing off and recognition of arbitrary authority. And when you realize that all language is an arbitrary authority, and that language is simply a medium to describe things socially, this is not something that most people want to hear who come from a very religious persuasion. Because what is it? It is the word of God, right?
Right.
It's the word of God. And so if there is no philosophical as well as physical linguistic lineage that people can follow, then a lot of these ideas, for some people, start to fall apart. For others, they have faith. Now, back to Johann Pestalozzi, one of his most famous students was an individual by the name of David Strauss, and he wrote one of the first books ever questioning the divinity of Jesus Christ. And so you can see why a lot of the opposition to the Illuminati or to German idealistic ideas has come from the religious right or from religious persuasions, because they are presenting ideas that are very much antithetical to the belief system that they espouse.
Right.
So it all comes down to polity management. And the reason why my website is called Unity of the Polis is because I identify this as the foundation of all politics in all societies going back to ancient Greece. And when you look at the history of liberal education, it's really been muddled by people that take this back to Plato and to Aristotle. It really goes back to Isocrates, who started his school 6 years before Plato even had his school up and running. So Isocrates created what was called the Enkyklios Paideia, which is the word we now know as the encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. Now, what is an encyclopedia? It's billed as a total education by somebody like the groups like the Encyclopedia Britannica. This contains all of the knowledge that we know in society. And that's very much what it was then. They were taking different arts from Egypt or from Chaldea or from elsewhere. And often where people would come to the city square or the agora type environments, and they would speak their or teach their knowledge from all parts of the world, where Isocrates decided he would put this into what he called the Enkyklios Paideia, or a total education. And then this leads to, later on, the trivium and the quadrivium of medieval times.
Now, when we say the phrase total education, we kind of imagine one with a perimeter or a boundary that we set for ourselves, but yes, that's not the idea here, and I think that's an important part of this, right?
Well, essentially what it comes down to is that when you don't know the official name giver, and you're trying to create an artificial education of the best of what is thought and said, you're inevitably leaving something out. You're inevitably like a Mortimer Adler who, when creating the book Great Books of the Western World for the Encyclopedia Britannica and the Great Books organizations, you know, he decided arbitrarily that black people didn't write any good books.
Right.
So it would be very easy to see how Isocrates might have some animus towards some of the barbarian cultures and decide that their languages and things were not effective or were not necessary to be taught. Or how Cecil Rhodes, in the colonization of South Africa and the looting of all their assets and riches, decided that the Matabele were not worthy of British learning, or some were and some were not. So it's very easy to delineate outsiders to your unity you're trying to sell as barbarians. So
right, absolutely, yeah.
And so and when you look at this, how it translates into technology, you know, it's the iPhones, that the technology that exists way into the future, and we're getting the planned obsolescence of that.
Right.
It's the $700 for a 1 terabyte solid state drive some years ago, and now down to, you know, whatever it is today. And these it's not as if solid state drives didn't exist at that terabyte level. It's that people can profit in the interim.
Yeah.
And that's the management of polities and the management of politics. And, you know, that's very much what I've been interested in, you know, how this history proliferated over time and how it still exists today. Because the United States, the foundation myths and things were kind of secondary to this new unifying principle, which they called law. And so law was supposed to be the unifying principle, and it didn't matter what language you brought to the law, because you were still bound by that law. You want to get off at this exit here.
All right.
So we don't go too far out of the way.
Well, this is a nice view of the arch. It was hard to find a view like that on the way in.
Mm-hmm. It really is. And I could take you down if you make a left here at the Laclede's Landing. Stay in this middle lane here.
Okay.
And just follow it left across. And we're going to go to the old part of St. Louis, where it'll turn into kind of cobblestone roads.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And there's the Iad's Bridge. One of these bridges is famous for, who was that that famous escape artist? It's escaping me right now. Famous magician, escape artist. Houdini?
Houdini, yeah.
Houdini. Yep. Yeah, he, in a cold winter many years ago, he put himself in a straitjacket and jumped off, I believe, the Iad's Bridge or one of these bridges that may not even be here anymore, into frigid, ice-cold, freezing water.
So we're going over this one right here?
Yeah, we're not going to go down. We're going to go straight across and then down the hill. We're not going to go over to Illinois. This is actually the Martin Luther King Bridge.
So,
yeah, straight. Follow that.
Okay.
That's S10 there. And this is what's called Laclede's Landing. You're about to see some Clydesdales or something.
Oh, wow.
Pulling people. It may not be Clydesdales, but they still do the horse-drawn carriage here, to the chagrin of many animal rights activists, I'm sure. But yeah, it's still pretty neat. You have the original roads.
Cobblestone, yeah.
This is kind of a bar district. Unfortunately, a lot of the big casinos have moved into here. Lumiere Plaza over here, and there's a Harrah's and other companies owned by the Carlyle Group. Go ahead and go straight down here. And we're going to take the road that goes just beside the arch.
Oh, we've come to the banks of the mighty Mississippi here.
Yes, we have.
It's pretty narrow here.
Yeah, it really is. And this is one way, so you're good to make a right here.
All right.
And, yeah, Mississippi does not look too low here. I've been reading a lot that it's been low in places, but it does not look too bad here. You have the GoPro going. That's good.
Yeah, we're shooting video of all this.
Awesome. Yeah, you can see they've kind of maintained some of the old bridges and things.
Wow, that's amazing.
Hopefully we can get some pictures of these, too, to share on the Facebook pages.
Oh, yeah, I'll pull them from this.
Yeah. Oh, you can do still shots. Yeah, that's great. Also, another interesting thing here for people that are interested in any modern art or urban art and things, the city of St. Louis allows, every year they have a big festival-type event called Paint Louis, where graffiti artists from all around the world come here to paint on the little tidal basin that we're going to see. Yeah, and so it's constantly done over and over and over again. I have some friends and family that used to be involved in such things. But yeah, so it's a good view of the arch coming up right underneath it.
Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah, I was trying to figure out how to get this close. Yeah. We are right there.
Yeah.
It's not as big as I thought.
No. I've not been up there.
What is it? How many feet tall is it?
I'm not sure. I think it's smaller than the Washington Monument. That would be my frame of reference growing up in the D.C. area. But not positive on the height of it. Looks like we're going to get behind a horse-drawn carriage here.
Oh, look at this. This is beautiful.
Yeah, and it has the entrance to it is underground. They have a museum on both sides you can enter, and there's a tunnel that goes from one end to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar, but you go up in this like kind of oval-shaped car that takes you up, and it just kind of ratchets its way all the way to the top.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen, and then there's like a observatory up there.
Yeah. Yeah, much like the Washington Monument. And you have like riverboat cruises.
Riverboat cruises!
Mm-hmm. And if you keep driving down here, you'll see a little bit about what I was talking about with the Paint Louis graffiti wall. It goes for, several miles, I think. Yeah, it's a 630-foot monument in St. Louis here. Stainless steel.
So from the arch is that long?
It says it's a 630-foot, I guess that's 192 meters. I guess it's the world's tallest arch.
Oh, it does? I thought it, see, I would have guessed 300 feet.
Hmm.
It's juxtaposed against nothing from where we are, or there's no backdrop to it. So, wow, look at that old factory.
Yeah.
Do you know what that is?
I do not. No.
There's my
a lot of them,
God.
A lot of them that line here. Some of them are still in. You can see the barges right here. They've got barges that go up and down, and they've got cranes to load them on. If you keep driving here, I'll show you a little bit of the graffiti wall. And then I'm going to have you circle back around towards the City Museum.
This right here?
Yeah, this is just a small portion of it. You just keep going straight. 10 things every St. Louis museum must do. Yeah. And it changes. You know, people come down here every day. And some people get disrespected and painted over. And others, you get tagged on. And
wow.
Pretty interesting. This is the Mill Creek Pumping Station. I'm not sure what that is. But as you can see, it goes on forever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It certainly does.
Yeah. And famous artists from all over the world come here. There are magazines for graffiti culture, like 12 Ounce Profit, and websites like Art Crimes that have featured this for a very long time. Free the Herb. And this is those eyes right there, that's actually a very famous St. Louis graffiti artist. He gets up everywhere. But it's rare. I guess this is one of the ways that they think they can curb graffiti elsewhere is by providing a place like this where people can come and do so legally. I don't know if it's usually just restricted towards the Paint Louis events, but I've seen people down here painting at all times of the day, even in the middle of the night.
This was the right choice to take a little extra time in St. Louis.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. And you know, I'd love to put forth some real organization and maybe come back on and do a full expose of some of the history of the St. Louis Philosophical Society. My intentions are to get into the archives and read on the Journal of Speculative Philosophy. This is a police officer. Hopefully we don't have any trouble. Just doing a little sightseeing of the...
Should we go up there?
Yeah, you can, or you can do a U-turn anytime you want, but we can... But that's pretty
really
neat,
something.
Isn't it? Yeah, it really, really goes on for a long time. Maybe not...
He is taking a bit of an interest in us.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, I'm sure he's just somebody that drives up and down and patrols and makes sure people aren't in the wrong place. One time I was across the river trying to get a picturesque shot of the arch, and before I could get my camera even down from taking a shot, I was accosted by police officers and told I was trespassing. Only licensed photographers can get that shot and sell it. So.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, they do a lot of protection for the casino industry here. Unfortunately, I moved to the Midwest back in 1993, and this area was very, very much run down. I think St. Louis has gone through a lot of revitalization since then, but some of the remnants of that, as you can see with the empty buildings and the older architecture, still exist. Wow, that's beautiful. I don't know if that's somebody's from Miami, I guess. Yeah, this is all new. It's a Halloween theme. But yeah, there would be no School Sucks without William Torrey Harris and the St. Louis Philosophical Society. I would urge people to look into that because William Torrey Harris himself is credited with being the one that creates the divisions between grade school and high school. There would be no high school without William Torrey Harris. And he was very prolific in designing some of the first curriculums. Where I have taken a particular interest, where it kind of meets my research, is that while William Torrey Harris was the first commissioner of education for the United States, he was the one that approved the Rhodes Scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
And so I pulled from the archives of the National Education Association a speech that he gave called Oxford and the Rhodes Scholarships, where essentially he lays out that he believes that Oxford is the last bastion of the seven liberal arts education, or the trivium and the quadrivium, and that the medieval university produced the best kinds of societies. And so what he sought to do was to approve the Rhodes Scholarships, first of all, to come into the United States as Commissioner of Education. But he wanted to do this in a way that would create a technocratic class, because he believed that, you know, because the realization that everything in society, all things are essentially art, which is another Rhodes Scholar famously came to that conclusion. This is what the elite and I know, is that at the highest levels everything is just art. Mm-hmm. And this is the same conclusion that cyberneticists like Heinz von Forster came to. If you watch the Net documentary, the Unabomber, LSD, and the Internet, he gives an interview with Lutz Dembeck in that documentary, where he describes that essentially the highest level mathematics, it just becomes an art, because there's so few people that are understanding the problems and things that you're working with, that it's a creative effort. And this is what the virtue of kings is, coming from Isocrates, you know, when he wrote to these Nicocles and these other mythical kings. The idea was that they would use education as a way to subdue the masses, and they realized this all the way back to ancient Greece. Now the problem for that, you know, historically, is that people like Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson chose in many ways to reject the Greek and Roman models, because they viewed the Greeks as creating a form of slavery that the Romans then perpetuated, because they weren't interested in sharing this with the masses. Thomas Jefferson rejected the curricular trivium, which comes from the Enciclios Paideia, at William and Mary College when he was governor. He went there and he revamped the entire curriculum, and he got rid of the indoctrination school that they were using for the Native Americans, forcing mm-hmm. forcing them to learn Latin and English at the time. As well as Ben Franklin, he decided to start his own American English school, and so did John Adams. And in the biography of Benjamin Franklin, he says that that they were going to reject Latin in favor of creating an American English. And these are what the efforts of Noah Webster kind of go towards. The idea that England at the time was still stuck on Latin grammar, and mm-hmm. teaching only the highest and most educated people, the most elite, rather, to be the most educated people, whereas the masses were simply fodder for the factories and for manual labor.
So Jefferson wanted to stop the indoctrination of Native Americans for the sake of allowing them to maintain their practices, their culture, or yes. was there yeah, some
well,
other?
Yeah, it's not to say that he was always the most altruistic person in terms of, you know, minority cultures or anything of that nature, but
right.
he had a strong infatuation with the, you can go ahead and go down towards this same way we came up. I'm going to take you towards the City Museum. But he had an infatuation with the Native American cultures, and there was always this need to discover original grammar.
Here?
Yep, keep on going straight.
Oh, all right.
We'll turn at the Lumiere Plaza and go up. When you see this big casino over here to your left, we'll take that and go up. He kept a big trunk. I talked about this in several of my discussions previously. Kept a big trunk of Native American languages. And what he was most fascinated with was that when one Native American tribe, let's say the Shawnee or the Sioux or the Cherokee, when there would be an infighting within like the Cherokee or any of these Native tribes, they would split off and create their own language in order to separate themselves. Because you wouldn't... Yeah, that's fine. We can turn at the next one. They all go to the same place. Or you can do a U-turn if you need to, but I think you can turn left.
I'm interested in this building. Right?
Oh, it's
Union
awesome.
Light?
Yep, Union Light. I've taken many pictures of this place. I don't know exactly what they... If this was like the electrical hub or what this was, or if it was... it is Union Light and Power Company, so it was a power company.
Wow, yep. Look over here. This is like...
Yeah. And then beyond that is the new Stan Musial Bridge. St. Louis is famous for their love of the Cardinals baseball, so they've got a bridge named after one of their players.
Looks like I could drive right in there.
Yeah, I don't know if that's frowned upon in this establishment or not, but I don't see any police.
The St. Louis Riverfront Trail. Oh, this must be...
Part of that same...
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, there's a truck there. I don't know if he's security or not, but man, this Free the Herb guy really gets up. He's up everywhere. Yeah, so Thomas Jefferson became so interested in these Native American languages. What he was most interested was that they were able to sever their communications to create a whole new language so they wouldn't give away their positions and their newfound unity. So
yeah.
That's what I find fascinating about that. It's not to say that his actions usually were in favor of the natives or of African Americans at the time or anything of that sort. But let's make a left here and then actually I think you can go straight. I'm going to take you over to the City Museum, but I found that especially fascinating because they didn't have the opportunity to do that. The languages that were being perpetuated in the elites, it was very much still the Latin grammar, logic, and rhetoric of Latin learning.
Right.
Within these circles, or the King's English, or, you know, these. And it was only meant for the richest among the people. Now we're going to go across. It's a little confusing. Go across to the second light here and make a left. And see that building over there with the Ferris wheel?
Yeah.
Let's head towards that.
All right.
The Ferris wheel on top of the building. So this is the same problem that John Adams saw. It's the same problem that Noah Webster saw. And it's very much, you know, the British are very, very proud of their vernacular and their language. And in fact, like somebody like Dorothy Sayers, who introduced the lost tools of learning into the United States, she believed that Americans spoke a sing-songy English. You know, that she looked down upon the American English. It was not proper. It was not holding to the standards that they feel they set forth. You should be able to turn right on Convention here, and that should take us in the general area of where we'd like to go, as long as it's not a one way.
Doesn't look like it.
No. I might just go to the convention center and then out, but we'll figure it out. So, I'm going to be writing. I have several chapters in the works on this for my book that deal with the American Revolution and the rejection of the classical trivium. It was very much because the classical trivium was being taught under a Christian godhead. Jefferson and others were very influenced by the practical education coming out of Humboldt. Mm-hmm. Humboldt's education, who established one of the first universities in the world, and then Thomas Jefferson's university, of course, being in Virginia, one of the first of its kind, and they sought to you know, his goal was to create a college where you were to come and go as you please, as you felt educated, if you were a man, of course.
Right.
Wasn't much egalitarianism.
Let's pause for a second. Sure. I want to see if I can get this camera going again.
Sure. I hope I'm...
No, this is great. Yeah. GoPro, turn off. It just shut off, and then I turned it back on. GoPro, start recording. So what's the attraction of the museum?
The attraction of the museum. I just went there recently. It's called the City Museum. If you're ever in St. Louis, I would do it over the arch. If you make a right here, it should take us in the general vicinity. It was created by an artist, I guess about 20 years ago. He passed away in 2011, unfortunately, in a construction accident on another project he was building. But he's an artist, and the goal of it was to turn this old shoe factory into a place where people could come to be inquisitive and to be amongst mixed mediums. And so it's I described it kind of like a Willy Wonka's without the chocolate factory part.
Mm-hmm.
You go in there and you buy a ticket, and they don't tell you where to go. There's no map, and you have to figure it out on your own. And throughout the entire 14-story, I believe, I know it's at least 11 stories because they have a 10-story slide. They have two 10-story slides.
Oh, wow.
Where you can go down all the way to the bottom. But it's a beautiful place. It's something that John Taylor Gatto would definitely find some philosophical agreement with, because it's a place where you're supposed to use your own imagination and your own capacities to discover.
Yeah.
And there is no set agenda. You go in and you explore, and it's full of caves and huge mosaic art pieces, as mm-hmm. well as a Ferris wheel on the roof. There's a school bus that's driving off the top of the building, that's hanging off the side of the building, which I think really fits into the school sucks philosophy.
Indeed.
And it's just there's no rules, and there's slides, and it's not just meant for kids. It's anybody can go there, and you can find something that you will want to tell others to come visit. I think it's rated like one of the number one family attractions in the United States. But it's really neat. It's an old shoe factory that they've converted. The whole first and second floor, as well as the roof, are part of this City Museum. And I guess it's been there at least 20, 25 years. But it's just a playland. You can go there and walk around and eat, and they have a circus inside where people are on trapeze and just
wow.
training and doing things on their own. They've brought in several rundown skateboard parks, and they've set up ramps on a whole floor where kids can just run and play. And I didn't know anything about it going in, and that's usually the best way to experience something, is when you can kind of give it meaning for yourself. And that kind of ties into the whole conversation, is that you know some of us want to live in a culture where the meaning is derived from the individual experience rather than the forced collective experience. It's not to say that there aren't actual collectivities, because we are all human, right?
Right.
But it's the forced collectivities of schooling and of arbitrary laws that you know we volitionally step outside of, because we are the sovereign. You know, the sovereign no longer should no longer resist in arbitrary state systems and in arbitrary power. And so you see, there's dinosaurs, you got airplanes, you have a school bus. See the school bus off the top of the building?
We're gonna have to find a place
go ahead
to
park right here. That's a parking place. That's a good one too, because is this a walkable GoPro? Can we get out and take a look?
All right,
it's really an amazing place.
We could pause, and then we could just pick this up with
yeah.
the GoPro.
Yeah, let's explore.